Good afternoon. Illinois Appellate Court, First District Court is now in session. The Sixth Division, the Honorable Justice Michael B. Hyman presiding, case number 22-1600. I'm sorry, case number 23-0360, John Thulis versus City of Chicago.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Justice Michael Hyman, and with me are my colleagues, Justice Carl Walker and Justice Sanjay Taylor. I'd ask that the appellant, appellee, please introduce yourselves and for the appellant, how much time you wish for rebuttal.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
I don't see Judge Horan.
Somebody has their... Morning.
No talking, please.
Go ahead.
Sorry. I'm not sure what happened. Good morning or good afternoon. My name is Ken Goldstein. I'm here on behalf of the appellants, John Thulis and Jason Webb. And I would like to reserve 5 minutes, please.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Elizabeth Tischer, and I'm here on behalf of the City of Chicago.
Thank you very much. Mr. Goldstein, you may proceed.
Thank you. In the Quitam case and False Claims Act case in Scacchetti, QVC, Burlington Coat, as cited by the Thornley case recently, they all hold that the state is the real party in interest. And here, the state's voluntary dismissal pursuant to the False Claims Act, Statute 175/4C2A, it was their dismissal. And the implication of that is that there are the two that at least all three elements, but here from that dismissal, two elements of res judicata are not met, and res judicata should not be applied. The first is the final judgment on the merits.
Just that the court decided this case on a different ground, correct?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Sorry. I would not seem to interrupt. The lower court, the defendants moved on res judicata and collateral estoppel, and the lower court ruled on collateral estoppel. And in the response brief, and we briefed both in our opening brief, and the city in their response essentially waived collateral estoppel, and this is de novo review. So for any reason in the record, of course, they argued res judicata. I'm prepared to argue both if the court would like.
No,
but
no.
They're so similar.
If they waived it, there's no reason for that, and their brief does not discuss collateral estoppel. With regard to the other matters that they raised for dismissal, non-jurisdictional,
right?
The judge did not consider those at all, correct?
Not at all. Not at all. And I'm prepared to discuss them because they are de novo review. It's a private right of action under the
abandoned. No, we know property. What they are. But so my question is, the relief that you're asking, you ask that we send it back for further proceedings. But what proceedings should we send it back for? Because we are a court of review, and the court has not reviewed the other, if depending on how we rule. I mean, I want to put that clear. I'm not clear where we're going to go. But should we rule in your favor, what I'm trying to find out is what happens when we send the case back? Shouldn't this case be sent back for the court to determine whether there should be a dismissal on some other grounds that were raised?
Sure. We would like the whole enchilada here. We would like the court to remove, since we are here, this has taken so long. On a de novo review of collateral estoppel, I think that the court should review the issue of res judicata and remand. And although we would like the court to then say, yes, there's a private right of action or these other causes of action could go forward, the circuit court should get a first attack at it so that the court of review has a basis to review it. It's fully briefed in the record, but so our request would be for a remand that the case is not barred by res judicata or collateral estoppel, and that then we would proceed on the merits motion practice of the uncashed checks under whatever causes of actions would, you know, they'll move to dismiss or
Mr. Goldstein, okay, so don't you that if we do rule in your favor and find that res judicata does not apply, that we could address the other defenses raised by the city because they're legal defenses in nature, and you know we're just as well equipped to handle those legal defenses as the trial court.
Oh yes, I think that you could, and that's why we briefed them and we addressed them and prepared to discuss them. That we think that the private right of action, that there exists a private right of action, that under the Abandoned Property Act, that that the Interest Act would apply under the fraud exception, that the Consumer Fraud Act claim would applies to suing the city, and that they're a city under they're a person under the act, under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. We also had conversion and their bad faith in suppressing this and negotiating it for about 12 years, and the ministerial act of a writ of mandamus. I think we also had unjust enrichment as well. And all those sort of gets subsumed into the private right of action claim, but they're different. They have distinct parts, and we think that we could, yes. So the short answer to
question. Why don't you go on to your res judicata arguments?
Sure. Thank you.
And Mr. Before you even start, Mr. Goldstein, that's kind of where I was going to take you as well. But this, it seems to me that the city's primary argument as to why this is res judicata is because your client objected to the dismissal. So, and they state that a few times in their brief. Can you kind of get us past that argument?
Sure. Our plaintiff's objection the relator's objection does not convert the state's voluntary dismissal into a non-voluntary dismissal because it's ministerial, it's non-adjudicative, and the state is given broad discretion under the statute under 740 ILCS 74. We'll just start calling it 4C2A. They have wide discretion to dismiss it. That was what the dismissal was on. This is not a 2-1-0.
They don't have absolute discretion. Would you concede that? They don't have absolute discretion?
Right. We would not. Yes. That was the basis of the Thulis decision and the qui tam. That's what we objected to, that that there needed to be a glaring, that we argued that there was a glaring evidence of bad faith. The standard in Illinois is clear after Polensky.
But don't you get past that issue because they were in the middle of negotiating with the city? So there was no bad faith on the part of the state. That's what you were just saying, that we realize that may be a basis, but that there was no bad faith here.
The dissent found the bad faith, but the majority opinion, which we respect, did not. And so the dismissal was on 4C2A under the False Claims Act, that the state has discretion to dismiss it for really any reason at all. So our objection essentially is irrelevant. It doesn't convert the dismissal because it was ministerial. The Attorney General made a motion. It is non-adjudicative. So because of that, it operates because Polensky says it and Thornley just says it, that the qui tam case is brought for the state. They move that way as a voluntary dismissal. Technically, and it's judicata because it was a 4C2A dismissal.
Right. So Mr.
Thornley said the state moved for dismissal during the seal period.
Mr. Goldstein, You're starting to repeat yourself just a little bit. So why don't you just go ahead and get, and this is what Justice Taylor asked before, get into your res judicata argument. Just tell us why it doesn't apply here.
It's not a final, judgment on the merits. The dismissal is voluntary by the state under 4C2A. Thornley held that the courts have never applied the standard of 21009 to dismiss for motion to dismiss in a state quitam suit. That's at paragraph 58 of Thornley. And the 2109 discussion, it's like it adheres to it. It supports it. And it doesn't, our objection doesn't convert anything. The rule 273 wouldn't apply because it's dismissal to a statute. So the case was dismissed. Was voluntarily dismissed. It was, and thus it wasn't a final judgment on the merits. And then there's also no identity of the parties. The case is brought in the name of the state and only of the state. And that's what Scaretti says. That's what QVC says. That's what Burlington says. That's what Polanski says. That's what Thornley says. And then finally, there's also no identity of the case and the our quitam case at the last paragraph, I believe it's paragraph 26, says that when we tried to amend and add a consumer fraud claim, the appellate court said that it was not it's a different cause of action. And this Your Honor, Justice Walker, you and Justice Hyman was on the decision in IPINA just very recently, saying it was a Rule 23 order. It was a collateral estoppel decision, but what you said, even though it's an unpublished decision,
I think we've lost Mr. Goldstein. So let's wait till he comes back. I think he was having some problems with this connection. There, you're back.
It dropped out right at the moment. Justice Walker and Hyman were on the panel in this division, and from this court in IPINA, it was a collateral estoppel case, and even though it's a Rule 23 opinion, it's replete with throughout the case law that collateral estoppel or res judicata prevents a party from losing an issue on the merits and then litigating it before a different judge to procure a different result. And that's just not the case here at all.
Mr. Goldstein, let me ask you a hypothetical, and I'm going to ask counsel for the city the same thing. So the False Claims Act permits someone to bring an action on behalf of the government. Quitam means the name, in the name of the king, but it also permits the government to bring an action against a defendant for violating the False Claims Act. So my question to you is, if the state somewhere down the road elects to sue the city under the False Claims Act, can it do so, or would it be subject to the res judicata bar?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's really not in front of us, and we don't have
I know. That's what happens on the bar, right?
But could I understand? Could you know? Polanski says that
your answer has to be yes, right? Your answer has to be yes. They could,
because
there was no final judgment on the merits.
Right. There was no final judgment on the merits to the state either. It wasn't just us. They voluntarily dismissed it. If we had the case to sort of address it, where they declined to intervene, and then the plaintiff goes forward, and then the state decides to move to intervene. That's what happened in several cases. And Thornley, that was what was the dumb that. I guess you threw me the lifeline that yes, it was a voluntary dismissal as to them, and they would have there was no hearing, there was no trial, there was no final judgment. So yes.
Well, the question is whether I mean, the question comes down to whether the voluntary dismissal somehow rubs off, so to speak, on the realtor. I mean, that's what the city argues, that there is a connection, and therefore the realtor has an interest. They use that term in some case law about interest. And because a realtor has an interest, they too are involved in that transaction.
Sure. The this court has found that the only the state has been injured by a false claims and is the real party in interest. That is in Thulis at paragraph 24, I believe. Scaretti says it, Burlington Code Factor. The real party in interest is the state. And the relator is not in the driver's seat. All the state can come back in, they can dismiss it. And because of that, it doesn't rub off. There's no close enough privity. Taylor versus Sturgill by the U.S. Supreme Court, which is cited in our brief, does not allow for close enough privity. Just because the attorney was the same, that is not enough. And if we had gone out and found a different, like there were, that let's not lose sight of the merits, that there were 22,000 people who had these stale checks totaling $11 million. There are other people who have these checks. The dismissal of ours couldn't then foreclose the others. I mean, that's the bottom line here. That's what the IPNA decision just illustrates, is what did not happen here was there was no adjudication on the merits. There was that's why I said technically under the law, under 2C4A, clearly it was just the dismissal. But in reality, all that happened was a one-line dismissal. If you look in the record, I believe it's at record site 1029, Judge Schneider's dismissal of the Qui-Tam case says it's from 4C2A, and they have unlimited authority, essentially, and it's dismissed because they said so. The Attorney General is not making a judicial finding. It's making an optional decision, not for whatever reason. Their resources are taxed. They don't think it's a good claim. They don't think it's a Qui-Tam case, whatever it is. So it doesn't rub off. There's no close enough privity. There's no implied privity between the parties. The claim was the state's, and really for res judicata, only one of the three elements need to be barred or blocked, and res judicata as an theory of equity is a doctrine of equity. Equity also applies here. There's no, like in other cases where there's no harassing type of litigation here. We brought the case as a Qui-Tam. They said no. The city did not even appear in the Qui-Tam case. The city did not file an appearance. They were not even served. The case was under seal.
Isn't that important? Hasn't that been pointed out by courts have said that that's a very early in the proceedings when it's still under seal, when that happens. I mean, that is an important consideration.
And that was the issue, Your Honor, as in Thornley, was that the plaintiff, the state had intervened to dismiss, and the court said, no. They had asked for time to investigate, and they moved for the purpose of just dismissing. And so here we have not, the city, you know, poo-pooed the idea that, oh, of course we were part of it, but they weren't, they were not served. They didn't file an appearance.
But do you agree with Thornley completely? I mean, it appeared to me that you sort of agree with everything it said.
Well, we went down the road that we thought that 2109 was really more dispositive, right. But it's really not. It's really more two trees that are growing side by side. They're parallel. Our case and that case are parallel. it supports the idea that it's not a dispositive, or that it's not a it supports the idea that the dismissal is voluntary, but it doesn't the court is saying that it's not pursuant to that. It's pursuant to the statute. And because it's pursuant to a statute, for sure, Rule 273 wouldn't apply. You can't constructively say then that this is a dismissal on the merits. Is both technically, that's why I'm making this distinction. Technically, it's on the statute. But in reality, when you look at the record, clearly there was nothing that was on the merits. And then when you apply an equity thought to it, when you apply equity to it, the city hasn't really expended any resources. They haven't answered anything. They are involved, but they, in, to the sense that, that they're the target, but they haven't been quote unquote taxed. They haven't had litigation costs or fees or appearance.
Let me ask, anyone else have any questions? Yeah, why don't you, you've reserved 5 minutes. You'll get your 5 minutes. You want to just finish up right now?
I think that I've really addressed all the res judicata issues. You know, this was not vexatious, duplicative or cumulative as we were discussing. And actually one last other point is that the cases are seeking different results. The qui tam case is brought on behalf of the state in the application of the abandoned property statute, and the injury is to the sovereign, to the state. In fact, the state is injured just by the city not complying with the law. There's a loss of sovereignty for violating the law. The consumer case is a different case. It's brought on behalf of the payees of stale checks to get their money, to get their notice. The consumer class and the qui tam are essentially, they have different interests. They're essentially slightly to the side. They have the act, the Abandoned Property Act, gives them, you know, notice, but here the city's keeping the float. They get the interest of the float, and rather than the state. So there's a difference in what the relief is. And I think that's important to show that they're different cases, the identity of the case, identity of the parties. They all sort of dovetail together in that way. So thank you for giving me a few extra moments, technical glitches and all that aside. I would like to also just tell you, thank you very much for giving us oral argument on it. I know the court does not always do oral arguments for everything, and we do appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do I have to formally say I'll reserve the rest of my time?
That's fine. Thank you. Ms. Tish.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. Plaintiff's claims here are nothing more than an end run around the state's exclusive authority to enforce
Ms. Tischer, before get going, can you address the issue that I think it was Justice Hyman originally asked Mr. Goldberg the question about whether the collateral estoppel issue, whether or not that's been waived?
Yes, Your Honor, we did not pursue collateral estoppel on appeal here because we believed that res judicata was the better fit, and we did brief that in the circuit court below. So we're asking this court to rule on res judicata grounds or to find that, that nevertheless plaintiffs failed to state any cause of action on their individual claims.
Now, and you realize that the trial judge found that this was a final judgment, and that the trial judge's basis, in fact, was that collateral estoppel apply, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, all right, we'll hear from you.
Let me just follow up on that. If we did, I mean, it's the same question I asked Mr. Goldstein. If we ruled in his favor on res judicata rather than yours, what happens next? I know you briefed the other issues that were raised by you to dismiss, which are related to the complaint. Do we decide those, or should that be decided by the trial court?
This court can decide those issues, Your Honor. I mean, they are questions of law, and the appellate court can affirm on the circuit court's judgment on any grounds supported by the record. So in this case, we don't have any, these claims, they're all legal, all questions of law that don't require any further factual development in the record. So this court can absolutely decide those claims if the court decides not to, that plaintiffs prevail on res judicata, it can determine that we would prevail on any of the other grounds as well.
Okay, thank you.
I would like to begin with res judicata and discuss the three elements. And all those three requirements are easily satisfied here.
Well, I know you say it's easily satisfied, but if it was so easy, I don't think we would be here.
True.
So this is not an easy case. It's a case that requires us to look a little deeper. So I just wanted to mention that.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, let me start with the first element, and that is that there was a final judgment on the merits. The Keytown dismissal was involuntary and with prejudice.
Well, let's go back, okay? How was it involuntary? I mean, you're saying it's involuntary because because the state did it? The Attorney General asked voluntarily to dismiss? That makes it involuntary for the realtor? That's your argument.
Correct, Your Honor. Indeed,
so How does that flow? Why would the realtor be affected when the statute gives the Attorney General the right specifically to do what the Attorney General did? How could that be? They can object, which is what they did. But you're saying that just turns the tables on the realtor. I don't follow that.
Well, Your Honor, correct. The state did voluntarily dismiss the case. And if you look to Seventh Circuit precedent, which we cite in our brief, I believe the primary case we rely on is CIMZNHCA, a bit of a mouthful. And that was, of course, under the Federal False Claims Act. But this court does look towards federal case law to inform its decisions under Illinois law. And in that case, it explained that, well, indeed, a voluntary dismissal by the state be without prejudice as to the state, allowing the state to potentially refile a claim against the defendant. It acts as an involuntary dismissal, meaning it's with prejudice to the realtors because they do have an opportunity to object. And in this case, the realtors did so. They did object. And so for their purposes, they did not choose to dismiss this case. It was over their objection.
And they're not bringing a quitam action again. They're bringing an action on their own behalf of different claims. It's not a quitam claim at all.
Correct, Your Honor. And that would go to the question of whether there's an identity of cause of action here. And there is definitely under Illinois precedent, the question on whether there's an identity of cause of action for res judicata purposes is whether the current claims arise out of the same transaction as the claims in the prior suit. And that's a very broad standard here. So even if the claims seek different relief, or if they're even fundamentally different in the words of the appellate court in Thulis 1, as plaintiffs point out, the appellate court categorized these as fundamentally different claims, but that does not undermine the point that these arise out of the very same transaction, and that was the city's alleged failure to comply with the Unclaimed Property Act. And in fact—
if I can ask you a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
On the identity of the cause of action. I understand that the case law talks about that test being a broad test. But here, really, the dispute that was resolved was not so much whether there was a violation of the False Claims Act. It was a dispute about whether the relator had the authority to continue to prosecute the action on behalf of the state. That was really collateral to the issue that was raised in the complaint. And so, in one sense, that might not be the same causes of action. So I wanted to hear from you on that. And then the second question I have for you is the question that I asked Mr. Goldstein, which is that if the state somewhere down the road elects to sue the city for violation of the False Claims Act, does the res judicata bar prohibit that prosecution?
So, Your Honor, turning to your first question about the differences between the quitam and the current claims. So it is true that the first suit involved just the quitam claims, but for res judicata purposes, the question is not whether just whether the claims were actually litigated, but whether, you know, it certainly bars other claims that could have been brought, but were not. And so plaintiffs could have brought their individual claims in the complaint alongside their quitam claims, but they failed to do so.
Well, so I don't know. I've never heard of that. I've never heard of a, is that permissible under the False Claims Act that a relator can sue on behalf of the government for violation of the False Claims Act? And alternatively, I guess you're saying that a relator, not a relator, a plaintiff can sue for his own injury? I've never seen that.
Well, Your Honor, we have not identified any case that explicitly resolves this issue, but I would point out that one of the cases that plaintiffs actually cite in their brief that they rely on, it's a Seventh Circuit case again, and it's called Laird. And in that case, the court was considering whether, for res judicata purposes, whether I believe that that case had been, there was a wrongful termination action brought individually on behalf of the plaintiff, and then later a quitam action against that his employer based on some conduct where the employer had allegedly defrauded the federal government. So the court never said, oh, we cannot litigate these in the same action. What the court did is what it looked at. Essentially, what we're asking this court to do here is look at whether, you know, say that they arise out of the same transaction. And in that case, I think the court called it whether they made a convenient trial unit. And so in that case, the court was looking at whether the allegations, there were parallels in the allegations, what the evidence would be to support the claims. And so the court, but there was no ruling in that case that, no, these claims just can't be heard together. And so
But here, you know, how would you try this case? I mean, you're saying, in order to reach what you just said we should do, we'd have to find that the unitary trial, that in one trial you could do all this. I don't see how that is even possible. And the fact that you have no case, and not only does the United States government have a fair, you know, a quitam action, but almost every state in the nation has had quitam since the 1800s. So, they're extremely different. It would be a real difficult case to do it simultaneously because you have so many different aspects. Because they're not representing themselves in one case, and then you're saying they're representing themselves at the same time. How's that going to work?
Well, Your Honor, I think what is important is what the evidence is going to be at trial, and
we don't know. Well, we don't know.
Well, of course, we don't know now what the evidence would be at trial. But what this court has, or I'm sorry, what the Illinois Supreme Court has said is that the most telling factor of whether two causes of action arise from the same transaction is, you know, the parallels in the allegations between the two complaints. And in this case, the complaints are in all respects nearly identical. So what we would have, we have the same exact allegations in the quitam.
The facts may be similar. The facts are similar, but the claims are completely different. Would you say that? Except in one case. I mean, there's one case where they overlap. But otherwise, they're different claims.
The claims themselves are different, but that's not determinative for purposes of res judicata. Again, it's really just whether they arise out of the same transaction. And in this case, they plainly do. And the courts have been, Illinois courts have been very clear that even if, even if the claims are different, even if they seek different theories of relief, that doesn't preclude the application of res judicata as long as those claims
arise. It just seems like it's hopelessly or hopelessly conflicted. I mean, if a plaintiff were to say that I'm suing on behalf of the government to recover the government's, you know, to redress the wrong to the government, and so that the government can recover, you know, money that it's owed, and then on the other hand saying, well, I've been injured and it's my money. I just don't see how that is even viable under the False Claims Act.
Well, Your Honor, essentially what plaintiffs are seeking under their quitam claims under all their claims is essentially what plaintiffs are asking for is they want the ability to claim their funds. And so whether you're looking at whether it's through the quitam claims or their individual claim.
Well, in the quitam claim, it's to recover on behalf of the government. So you know, they would get the bounty, so to speak, you know, the that's provided, but you know, they're suing for the government's funds, not for their own funds.
Correct, but in the Quitam case, the issue would be whether the city is obligated to comply with the Unclaimed Property Act, and that's essentially the what plaintiffs are asking this court to decide as well, is whether the city is required to comply with the Unclaimed Property Act. So for those two questions, it would be the exact same evidence, the exact same, you know, determination.
So let me ask you, I know you didn't have a chance to address directly the second question, but if the state were to sue the city in its own name for violation of the False Claims Act, somewhere down the road, would they be barred by res judicata?
It's possible under the Seventh Circuit precedent that we've identified, that court did say that if it was voluntary, if the dismissal was voluntary and without prejudice on behalf of the state, there's always the possibility of the state bringing another action. But that if it's involuntary on behalf of the relators, then it's with prejudice to the relators, and the relators are not able to bring another action.
The court didn't say that. You're saying that. The second part.
Oh, excuse me.
Pardon. In your answer to Justice Taylor's question, your answer, I believe, to his question was yes, the state could. But then you went on and said, referring to the Seventh Circuit case, that the relators would be barred. But I don't think that case says that.
Well, the case didn't come out and explicitly say the relators would be barred, but what it said is
that's right. That's right. And that's why
it operated as an involuntary dismissal with prejudice as to the, it was with prejudice as to the relators. I'm sorry if I maybe misspoke and overextended the holding there, but the import of that holding, though, is that it doesn't matter for the purpose of the relators whether the state's dismissal was voluntary. It's still with prejudice as to the relators, and it's still involuntary as to them. And Illinois courts, their test under res judicata for whether there's a final judgment on the merits, as long as it was with prejudice as to the relators, no opportunity to amend the complaint, then it operates as a final judgment on the merits.
Even though Mr. Goldstein said this was all done before you appeared.
Well, Your Honor, the purposes of...
Am I right? Am I correct?
It's actually not clear in the record.
Whether... You should know in the other case, I mean, there was the litigated, the earlier case, the appellate court, City of Chicago wasn't even a party.
It certainly, there's nothing, we're not really sure from the record. I mean, that certainly may be the case. But I would like to point out that for the purposes of res judicata, the primary determination of whether... It should apply at all, if you were looking at sort of the equity side of things, is not specifically whether the defendant is prejudiced, but it's also for the, you know, res judicata, this is for judicial economy as well. And that's the main purpose behind this, is that we have courts litigating, you know, in this case, the circuit court had if plaintiffs had brought these claims in their original complaint in the quitam, and the circuit court had been able to consider them at that point, we wouldn't be burdening the circuit court now with considering.
We've already gone over that, and I think we've gone over that. Okay.
Ms. Tisser, the issue here is you're claiming that it's with prejudice, but it was with prejudice as to their ability to bring a claim on behalf of the state. There was no prejudice to their ability to bring their own claim, which is what's happening now. So just kind of take us through that. And I really want you to take some time and take us through this, because you've kind of put so many of your eggs in this basket as it relates to res judicata. And so you seem to have abandoned some other arguments that you may have had. So just take us home on this res judicata issue, because I struggle with prejudice. And maybe you can start there and then go through any other issues that you believe we need to hear about. And we'll kind of listen for a minute. How about if we give you 2 minutes? We're going to listen and not ask any questions.
Sure. Well, with respect to your first question, Your Honor, about whether, you know, that this was with prejudice to the relators, or sorry, if it's relators, ability to bring another quitam. But that's not, when we're looking at res judicata, it's not just whether the plaintiffs in the first case are able to bring the same claims again that they brought in that case, but whether there were other claims that could have been brought in that case that they failed to bring. And in that case, they could have, our argument is that they could have brought all of their other individual claims in their original complaint because they did arise out of the same transaction. There wasn't anything, you know, any new factual developments that occurred between their original complaint and their amended complaint, or in this case, that you know, that these were somehow new claims that they weren't aware of. And so that's the question we're looking at. It's not whether there was a decision saying that plaintiffs were, you know, with prejudice couldn't bring these specific claims, but it's that they could have brought them and they chose not to do so. And I would like to just hit on the final point of res judicata, and that's whether there's an identity of parties. And so plaintiffs have argued that it's only the state that is the real party of interest in a qui tam. And the Illinois Supreme Court has in Scachetti, which we cite in our brief, has said that actually it's the relators are also parties in interest in a qui tam. And actually under the False Claims Act, the Illinois False Claims Act, the General Assembly has specifically said that relators are also parties to a qui tam, and that they bring the action on behalf of the state and on behalf of themselves. And it's based on, you know, in that assignment of the state's damages or the award that relators get is what gives them the interest in that qui tam. And the Illinois Supreme Court has made this very clear. It's also very clear.
I don't think that's what the Illinois Supreme Court said. I think you're overstating what the court has said. They said they might have an interest, but that's different than what you just said. Let me use a hypothetical. How about if we have a lawsuit by a parent for a minor child? Would you say the parent can't bring a claim on behalf of themselves after they litigated the claim on behalf of the child? And they didn't bring a claim for themselves in the case with the child?
That would be very difficult to answer, not knowing what, if there was some interest that the plaintiffs or that the parent maybe had in the case,
under the law, a parent is legally distinct from the child, right? The child can't bring the action. Here in a qui tam, they're bringing it because the state didn't bring it, right? So I'm analogizing those. And the law, you can accept it or not, is that the parent can bring a separate action on their own behalf for their own damages and their own claims. But you're saying that some way in qui tam, that's not possible. Even though I don't know of any case that says it as succinctly as you just said the Illinois Supreme Court did. And if that was true, we wouldn't even be here. And if that was true, and I'd like to hear you respond to this, because you haven't responded to it at all, the Tornley case. I mean, they rely on the Tornley case. And that seems to counter some of the things you've just said. So how would you respond to Tornley?
Well, Your Honors, Tornley and the other cases that plaintiffs have cited, I believe they mentioned Polanski as well, those cases deal with the standard of review that the court is looking at when they're determining whether to, how to address a state's dismissal of a case. And I believe that there are cases, I'm just trying to, I believe that the import of those cases is that the courts were just looking at how to review the state's voluntary dismissal, like what standard, how much discretion to give the state. There's never a question for res judicata purposes whether the plaintiffs or the relators would be considered, that whether the case would be involuntary as to the relators for purposes of res judicata, or whether it would be with prejudice to the relators. And as far as the question of the parties in interest, it was Scachetti that did say that qui tam plaintiffs have a personal stake in the outcome and are also a real party in interest together with the state. But I do want to point out that for the purposes of res judicata, being the real party in interest, that's not really the test. It's just, were they a party to the action? And clearly, relators who bring a case under the False Claims Act, they're bringing it on behalf of themselves. They're bringing it as well as the state, and they're clearly parties. They are given certain rights under the statute, even if the state is ultimately able to have broad discretion to dismiss the case. The relators are given.
We shouldn't follow Polanski. Is that, we should ignore the United States Supreme Court? Is that what you're telling us?
Well, the United States Supreme Court didn't rule on the issue directly.
Well, it talked about voluntary dismissal, and if what you're trying to do is use the voluntary dismissal as a bar, and the only way that could be is if they're the same party. If they're not the same party, then it wouldn't affect the relators. So unless you win this argument, I mean, you need all three to succeed. And so that's why your argument is what it is. But I don't see how that would fit under Polanski, which is the most recent word.
I apologize, Your Honor. Polanski dealt with voluntary dismissal and how to consider the standard of review to consider to consider whether the government could basically have some sort of unfettered discretion to dismiss the quitam. There was that case didn't involve res judicata. There was no discussion of whether, you know, a relator who comes back later as a plaintiff is able to refile, bringing essentially the same claims that they brought in the quitam. So we don't disagree.
Doesn't it say that the relator could bring the voluntary dismissal does not bar the individual's claim, the relator's claim individually for their own damages?
I'm sorry, could you?
That the Supreme Court said that the voluntary dismissal by the state does not bar the relator's individual claim for damages.
No, Your Honor, we're not arguing that the court said that. We're merely arguing that we don't believe that Polanski determines the issues here. We're not disagreeing with Polanski as far as it goes, but it doesn't address.
So you say it has no relevance?
Does
it have any relevance to this case?
I don't believe it does have relevance, Your Honor. I think its relevance would just be for assessing what standard to look at the state's ability to dismiss a case, whether it has broad discretion. And so that was what was relevant in Thulis 1, and that was what it was at issue in that appeal. And in this appeal, we're just looking at whether res judicata, whether the decision in the quitam was with prejudice as to the relators. And Polanski doesn't squarely address that question.
What about Thornley?
And Thornley relied on Polanski as well. And Thornley doesn't expressly address that question either. Thornley also considered whether a state, as the government in the false claims under the False Claims Act, has the unfettered discretion, or just basically how to resolve the issue under a state's motion to dismiss. But it didn't address the nature of how that impacts a relator on when they're coming back with individual claims, how that works under res judicata. And as far as the issue with the real party in interest, obviously Scachetti doesn't specifically address the ability of plaintiffs to come back and bring individual claims later, and we're not saying that it does, but Scachetti stands for the proposition that relators, as well as the state, are also parties in interest. And the False Claims Act itself, the General Assembly was very clear that the state is also a party in the case. So,
Question? Any other question? No. Okay, if you could finish up, please.
Sure. For all the reasons we've explained, plaintiffs' claims are barred by res judicata. And I would just like to briefly point out that even if this court were to decide in plaintiff's favor on res judicata grounds, for all the reasons we explain in our briefs, they have simply failed to state any viable cause of action under any of the other claims that they bring. And this court should affirm the judgment of the circuit court.
Thank you very much. Mr. Goldstein, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you. The Laird versus Lockheed case was actually a Fifth Circuit case, not the Seventh Circuit. And it held that the plaintiff's quitam claims were not barred by claim preclusion despite the extinguishment of their wrongful termination claims. And there were different unit of issues, and so it denied the issue on the identity of claims, which we've addressed because of the Quitam case in Thulis addresses the claims issue. And in fact, and also the Southern District of Illinois decision on that they were raised with Chusmera gets addressed in our case as well extensively, because it was really about what was the discretion, should they look at, like, what was the discretion to the court and how much hearing should occur, like glaring evidence of bad faith versus like other statutes. I don't think it really applies here. Also answering Justice Taylor's question about the state coming back, this issue is ongoing, so they would also have another basis because this doesn't seem to be a one-off issue. It's an ongoing, potentially it's an ongoing issue.
I'm not sure I finally understand, Mr. Goldstein. I didn't understand what you were saying there. What does that mean, ongoing?
That they're not giving notice is ongoing. That they're not turning it over is ongoing. So there's a new cause of action over time. It's not just we found 20 years of not turning over the checks, and then 2008.
Okay. Are you saying that with respect to prior instances of the city not turning over checks, that any claim that the state might bring against the city for those prior instances would be barred by res judicata?
No.
Okay.
No, I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying that they would have an additional other claims that it was ongoing as well. So it came to mind that the issue here is that the defendants or the city has a lot of arguments. They don't have a best argument. Their argument that this is an end run around a decision, it just doesn't comport with the record that the state moving voluntarily under a statute to dismiss, where they have broad discretion to dismiss, should not foreclose a plaintiff, a relator, to then bring other claims, even though that they're parallel to each other. They should not be foreclosed that way. Our best argument, although we say that all the elements are not met, equity, claims, identity of parties, the key one of all of them, our best, is that there's no final judgment on the merits. QVC, Scoretti, Scicchetti, and Burlington Coat, and then Thornley, and even Polanski, they all say that this case, quitam is brought in the name of the state. Scicchetti particularly says only the state has been injured by false claims and is the real party in interest. And Scicchetti also, that was the Thulis case. I think it was maybe citing Burlington Coat. But Scicchetti says that the relator is subordinate to the state's interest. And when the state moved pursuant to a statute, then it's the state's voluntary dismissal, and it doesn't operate as on the merits. It's voluntary. And thus,
that's Tisher's primary argument, though, is that it was dismissed with prejudice as to your client. And she also raised the additional argument that your client could have brought their claim in that suit and they didn't. So as it was dismissed as to the claim they brought with prejudice as to them. And it was also dismissed as to any other claim that they could have brought.
Right. And that is under Rule 273. And under Rule 273, it says that if it's pursuant to a statute, it's not involuntary. It's not it's not with prejudice. It's a voluntary dismissal.
I don't want to cut you off, but I just want to be clear that I want you to stay with her argument that the problem is that it was involuntary as to your client because they objected. And I think that Ms. Tischer would have taken a different position had they not objected.
That went to the very first question that we were asked today, which was, does our objection convert the state's voluntary? And ours is, we're in the back seat on that. Our objection was to not, does not convert the dismissal on the state, because the state can move and lack of resources, not interested, as long as it's not glaring bad faith. So it doesn't convert it. And because it was to the statute, it doesn't constructively create an adjudication on the merits when technically it wasn't. And then when you look at the record and equity and all that, it then also, sir, it doesn't convert it and
But what they don't even say the case. Mr. Goldstein, you're repeating yourself. That's the only reason why I jumped in. What she's arguing again, though, is that your client could have brought their cause in that case, and had they done that, that part of the case would not have been dismissed.
Sure. That, you know, the retaliation claim sometimes get brought with a whistleblower claim, like a whistleblower claim will sometimes get brought with a qui tam case, because they can form a significantly together interest, but that's not the situation here. We have distinct relief requested, and even in the appellate court in Thulis, in the qui tam case, questions whether it was a qui tam case and that the amendment to amend the complaint was denied was in part because they didn't mesh up like that, like you're suggesting. So I think that's not that shouldn't be a bar to us.
And just to be clear, Mr. Goldstein, I'm not suggesting anything. I'm just simply telling you what her arguments have been.
Right. Yeah.
I have not suggested anything, and I don't have a position on the case. I'm just trying to listen to both your arguments, and I wanted you to respond to her argument because you have not done so.
Do you think that I have now? Have I not answered your questions?
You've sort of answered it.
Okay. The end one, though, here is that this is not an end run around anything. Because the court has never, nobody has addressed the merits of this claim, and the idea that one should preclude the other doesn't have any support. And for those reasons, we would ask that the court remand the case for further proceedings, that denying that the claim is barred by res judicata.
Thank you. Thank you to both of you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you to both of you. We're well prepared today. We appreciate that. Your briefs were well done, well argued, and we also appreciate that. We'll take the case under advisement and decide in due course. So thank you very much, and have a good and hopefully a cool afternoon.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you.